Okay, good afternoon, everybody. And this is Bio 241. We're going to finish the sensory chapter today, which is 10, and probably move on to 11 afterwards. We're talking about the eye. We're going to finish up with the eye. But we got some stuff on the board. There is SI today. What time? 3:45? Yep, 3:45 to 5:15. Okay, cool. And I'll have to let you know next time if we're going to have the exam on the 19th. It's or if we're going to push it back. I'm not exactly sure how that's going. But I'll let you know soon about that. Let's see if I have any other announcements. Yeah, question. Okay, I'm sorry. I couldn't quite hear you. The final exam. You know, it's not one of my classes. It's not published in the syllabus correctly, and it might be this class. So I think the best thing to do is just to look at the schedule of classes and look. I don't have the schedule of classes with me, so maybe I'll have to send everybody an email when it is. Okay. Let's see what else. Well, this semester we've had SI, supplemental instruction, and we've had SI leader and Lynn. Maybe you shouldn't say your name in the recorder. But anyway, our SI leader, all chances are, won't be around for next semester. And so we're always looking for SI leaders for various classes. It could be chemistry class, anatomy class, and even this class. And the nice thing about that is that SI leaders do get paid, starting at $8.50 an hour up to $13.50 an hour. And I don't know how many hours you can get in a week. About how many hours can you get in a week?
20 mats for under two, so 20, it can be about 10.
Okay, so 10 to 20 hours. So 10 to 20 times, you know, $8.50. That's per week. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's decent. Okay. So if you're interested in doing that, I have some flyers right here that you should come and take or talk to me about it, and I can forward your name to the proper people. Now, this course might seem like it's fairly advanced material, but it's still pretty basic information. So if you want to get a really good handle on the information yourself, the best way to really understand something is to be a teacher of that information, basically. So if you're going to move on to some other kind of studies and you would really like to know this material, the best thing to do is actually to help teach other people how to understand this material so you'll be really versed with it, right, if you become an SI leader or chemistry or whatever the particular class might be. So if you're interested, please talk to me about that. All right, so let's see. Getting on to senses, in particular vision. What kind of sense is vision? It's a special sense, right? Because you only have two eyeballs, and that's the only place where you can see photons. You can't see with your fingertips or knuckles or kneecap or anything like that. All right, so that's the difference between a general sense and a special sense. All right, and what about the layers of the eye? What are some layers of the eye? What's the outermost layer? The sclera. Does it contain photoreceptors? No, it's just connective tissue, gives the eyeball its shape in particular. And then there's another layer that contains blood vessels. What layer is that?
Choroid.
That's the choroid. That's where blood vessels should be. Blood vessels should not be in the retina, because what do you have in the retina? You have photoreceptor cells. And if you have a blood vessel, it's going to push a photoreceptor cell out of the way, and that's going to produce a vision deficit of some kind. If there are a lot of blood vessels in the retina, that's going to produce complete blindness. Okay, so what we see right here is a slide. Let's see if I can find what light I'd like to turn off. That one? No. That one? No. Oh, that one. Do you mind?
Nope.
Okay, good. Okay, so the retina contains basically two kinds of photoreceptor cells, and those are, by their shape, rods and cones, all right, and they have different functions. They have different locations in the retina, and they have different functions. Which one functions in black and white vision? Grayscale, no color information. Those are the rods. And where in the retina do you have rods? Central vision or peripheral vision? The rods are in your peripheral vision. Okay. They're in your peripheral vision. The cones are in your central vision. And with cones, what kind of vision do you have? You have color, number one. And number two, those are very small cells that don't operate through a lot of convergence. They're usually just hooked up one-to-one to your brain. So they give you the best resolution. They give you the finest detail. So cone cells in the periphery are only good for grayscale or black and white information. But the beauty of those cells is that they can actually sense in very dim light. So peripheral vision works in dim light, but only in black and white. Central vision gives you color vision, fine detail, but you need bright light in order to see fine detail and color. So here we have the two kinds of cells, right? The rods and the cones. And the cones actually are quite a bit smaller than the rod cells, unlike what we see on this particular diagram right here. All right, and this is the part of the eye that contains vitreous humor. So this is the posterior chamber. Notice that light has to pass through fibers of the optic nerve, these ganglion cells, amacrine cells, these nice bipolar cells, and horizontal cells before they get to the photoreceptors. They have to pass by all of these different cells. Okay. So this is a better diagram of how the cells match up in scale. So here are the synaptic endings, which are going to release neurotransmitter onto the bipolar cells. And here's the soma of these cells. And then there is an outer segment. So here's an outer segment with discs. Here is a cone cell, an outer segment with discs. These are the actual parts of these photoreceptor cells that can absorb light and then alter action potentials that are going to the brain. So this is the inner segment. Here is the outer segment that contain photopigments. All right, new discs are continuously added at the base, and then they're sloughed off at the tip. And there are jobs in the epithelium, or there are cells in the epithelium whose job it is to recycle these fragments of the rod and cone cells. All right, so the retinal pigment epithelium phagocytizes the old discs from the tips. And this pigmented layer also absorbs excess light. So for instance, if light enters your eye, you don't want it bouncing around or flashing around inside your eye, because then you'll see actual flashes inside your eye. And it also delivers nutrients from blood to the photoreceptors. It helps suppress immune attack on the retina, and that would be an autoimmune disease. And it stabilizes ion levels around these photoreceptor cells. So the pigmented epithelium right here has a pretty important job. All right, so in order for you to be able to sense light, there has to be a pigment in your eyes. And the pigments are contained within the discs. And in rod cells, the pigment is called rhodopsin. So what the heck is a pigment again? What is a pigment? It's any kind of chemical that can absorb light, right? It's any kind of pigment that can absorb light. And when it does, rhodopsin dissociates. It breaks down into retinol and opsin. So here we have an example of retinol and opsin. So this molecule right here is what we're going to call rhodopsin, right? Because it has these two components. And the retinol is all in a cis configuration. Right, see the cis configuration right here, 11 cis retinol. There's a little bend in the retinol molecule. And this is the molecule that can absorb light. And light is just energy. And when it absorbs that energy, a bleaching reaction takes place. And that's when the cis retinol changes to this all trans retinol. So we have a nice linear kind of molecule. And it dissociates from opsin. And that causes changes in permeability, which results in a difference in action potentials in the ganglion cells, which eventually will end up in the brain. Okay, so here is rhodopsin, and here is bleached rhodopsin. which is retinol and opsin put together. All right, so the ganglion and amacrine cells produce action potentials. Rods, cones, bipolar, horizontal cells produce graded potentials. Visual transduction is the inverse of other sensory systems. So usually, when we stimulate a receptor cell, what is happening to a receptor cell when we stimulate it? What happens to a receptor cell? Has something to do with an ion. Okay. So what ion, what do you think that ion does? Just think back to your original diagram of an action potential. What has to precede the formation of that action potential or the stimulation of that action potential? There has to be a stimulus. And what is that stimulus? Depolarization or a hyperpolarization? Yeah, it's a depolarization. How normally do we depolarize something? We take what kind of ion and move it which way across the membrane? A sodium ion is perfect. That's a cation. And we allow it to go inside the cell. That depolarizes the cell. Brings it closer to threshold. So that's typically how a normal sensory receptor cell works. Right? We looked at that in terms of the gustatory sense. For instance, if we put some acid in our mouth, that hydrogen ion is a cation that enters through a proton channel that depolarizes that gustatory cell, which then excites the gustatory axons going to the brain. And for the sense of salt, you have sodium, right? If you eat salt in your mouth, that dissolves, binds to a taste cell, and that sodium just moves right through a sodium channel, depolarizing that cell, stimulating that cell. That's typically how we would think how a receptor cell works. But for light, it's a little bit different, right? We say that is, it works in the opposite way or inverse way. So in the dark, when you're in a dark situation, are we stimulating the retina or withholding stimulation from the retina when you're in the dark? What would you normally consider a stimulus for vision? Let's turn the lights off and you could tell me, what do you see with the lights off? Nothing, right? So in order to see something, we need to turn the lights on. So normally, we would think that a stimulus is going to cause a depolarization, but that's not really true in terms of the rod and cone cells. In the dark, photoreceptors release inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarizes these bipolar cells that are in between the optic nerve and the rod and cone cells. Light inhibits the photoreceptor cells from releasing this inhibitory neurotransmitter. And thus, what happens to the bipolars? They become stimulated when there is light. All right, so I'm going to have to show you a couple of diagrams of this, and I think it might make a little sense to you. Okay. Rods and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. So what does that mean? In the dark, what's happening to rod and cone cells? Rod and cone cells in the dark, they are being stimulated, right? Because of dark, when they're not absorbing light, they're depolarizing. And when they depolarize, they release neurotransmitter. And the funny thing about this, the neurotransmitter that they release is inhibitory, not excitatory. So in the dark, this depolarizing sodium current is what we call the dark current. Why do we call it a dark current? Because under what conditions does it happen? In the dark. Right, when there's no light. So that's why we call it the dark current. And light, on the other hand, hyperpolarizes by closing these sodium channels. All right, so let's get a feel for what's going on here. And this has to do with a G protein coupled receptor. So here is the cell membrane. It looks like a nice cell membrane. And here we see a sodium channel. And in the dark, this sodium channel is open. And you see sodium entering the cell right here. What is that doing to the electrical property of the cell? When sodium, it's depolarizing the cell in the dark. So that's why we call this a dark current. And this sodium channel is open because it has bound a messenger inside the cell, namely cyclic GMP. So this is a lot like cyclic AMP, but it's just a different nucleotide. Okay. Let's look in this part. So here we have a disc in the outer segment of a rod cell. Here is a cis retinol, all right, so Here's the G proteins. And here is a phosphodiesterase. What does phosphodiesterase do? Yeah, it can break down. It can take a phosphate off. All right. Actually, it can cause an ATP to form cyclic AMP, or it can take guanosine triphosphate and form a cyclic guanosine monophosphate. That's what a phosphodiesterase does. All right, so when light hits this pigment, rhodopsin, it causes a shift, a change in the retinol from the cis retinol into the all-trans retinol. That activates the G protein. The alpha subunit dissociates, and it's just going to float around inside the cell. And what does it bump into? That inactive phosphodiesterase. And when it bumps into the inactive phosphodiesterase, right, it activates it. And the phosphodiesterase then converts cyclic GMP into regular old GMP. And this regular old GMP can't bind to the sodium channel. And when it dissociates from the sodium channel goes through a conformation change and closes. And what happens to the electrical properties of the cell in the light? Does it continue to depolarize or hyperpolarize? It hyperpolarizes. All right, so this cell is no longer stimulated. It's not going to release neurotransmitter. All right, so this might actually be an exam figure. So in the dark, what is this rod cell doing in the dark? It is depolarizing or hyperpolarizing? Depolarizing, which is what? Being stimulated or being inhibited? It's being stimulated in the dark. So that's really strange that photoreceptor cells are being stimulated in the dark. And in the light condition, because of rhodopsin and this G protein right here, when there is light, the rod cells are inhibited by closing these sodium channels. Okay, let's look at another diagram. So here is another really nice exam figure right here. So we got to go over this one really good. All right, so we have two different conditions. We see rod cell. Okay, here's that outer segment. Here's the inner segment. Here's a bipolar cell. Here's a ganglion cell. And over here, the same sequence of cells, rod cell, bipolar cell, ganglion cell. On the left is in the dark, and on the right is under light conditions, when light is hitting these cells. So let's look at these two circumstances. Okay, so in the dark, okay, so don't forget, in the dark, what's the level of cyclic GMP in the dark? Let's go back. Right. In the dark, there's plenty of cyclic GMP because phosphodiesterase is inactive. So there's plenty of cyclic GMP in the dark, and it binds to the sodium channel and keeps the sodium channel open. Okay, so the sodium channel is open here in the dark. Why? Because there's plenty of cyclic GMP inside the cell. All right, and here we have the sodium-potassium pump. It's pumping sodium out, potassium in. Okay, and this potassium channel is open, so this cell right here is just depolarizing. But the neurotransmitter that's being released because of that depolarization is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So what's the effect on the bipolar cell in the dark? Is this bipolar cell being stimulated or inhibited in the dark? Okay. Because this is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So in the dark, the rod cell is being stimulated, but the bipolar cell is being inhibited. So it's not going to release stimulatory neurotransmitter on this ganglion cell. Therefore, action potentials are not being sent to the brain. Okay, and where do you have the awareness or consciousness of your environment, including light? Where do you actually have the perception of seeing something? Is it because these cells are depolarizing? Or what cells? And what's the nature of that signal? Where do you have the perception of vision? Yeah, the brain. What part of the brain? The occipital lobe, right. So action potentials have to get to the occipital lobe in order for you to have that perception of vision via these ganglion cells. But in the dark, the bipolar cells here are being inhibited, so the ganglion cells aren't sending action potentials to the occipital lobe to give you the sense of vision whatsoever. All right, but now let's look at in the light. Okay, in the light, don't forget, photons are absorbed by retinol. It dissociates into opsin, right? Or rhodopsin dissociates into retinol and opsin. That activates the phosphodiesterase, converting cyclic GMP into regular old GMP. That closes the sodium channel right here. Okay, and that stops the release of inhibitory neurotransmitter. So now what happens to the bipolar cell? If it's not being inhibited, it depolarizes and releases excitatory neurotransmitter, stimulating action potentials on this ganglion cell, which then go to the occipital lobe to give you the sense of vision. Okay, so that's why we call this system the inverse of a typical receptor system. Because in the dark, what are the rod cells doing? They are depolarizing, but in the light, they are hyperpolarizing. But don't forget, this neurotransmitter between the rod cell and this bipolar cell is inhibitory. So it works the other way that you would expect it to work. Okay. All right, so the place where we have the highest visual acuity is in the fovea centralis. That's right in the center of the macula lutea. There's a little pit, and it only has cone cells. All right, and in this region, every ganglion cell, here we see it over here, every ganglion cell has only one cell, one cone cell, synapsing with it. So in order for this one ganglion cell to send action potentials to the brain, or this one ganglion cell to send action potentials to the brain, this cone cell has to absorb the right amount of light energy. Right? And same for each neighboring cone cells. So this is why we have very high spatial resolution in the fovea centralis, because these cells, what, are just a microscopic distance apart from each other. Right? As opposed to in your peripheral vision, where we have rods, right? Notice that for every bipolar cell, how many rod cells do we have? Well, in this particular case, three, right? So this region is going to be more sensitive because this bipolar cell is going to send action potentials to the brain, right? But look, there's even another step of convergence between these bipolar cells, synapsing on this ganglion cell. Doesn't matter if a light shines over here, or over here, right, or anywhere in this whole region, right, it's going to send action potentials to the brain. So this is much more sensitive, but right, your brain can't tell if light was received over here or way over here. So it's much more sensitive, but it doesn't have the same resolution. As opposed to cone cells, your brain can tell if this cell had light on it, or this one, all independent of each other. Okay, so on the left, this is highly sensitive, but low resolution. On the right, it's high resolution, but you need more light shining on the retina. So the degree of convergence of rods on ganglions is much greater. This allows for high sensitivity, but low acuity in this region right here. Okay, we sort of talked about eye movements before, having to do with being coordinated by the superior colliculus. This allows you to pursue movements of objects in a very smooth fashion. We call that tracking of moving objects and keeping an image focused on the fovea centralis, because the fovea centralis is where you have your highest acuity vision. And if you're not tracking an object, right, and just looking around the room, your eyes don't sweep in a nice continuous fashion. They actually jump from one object to the next, to the next, to the next. So we call that saccadic eye movement. And your brain picks out what the outstanding features of your environment are and focuses its attention on that one object for a split second. All right? So that movement is called a saccade. So when you move from one object to another, and that motion is called saccadic eye movement. So your eyes actually, when you're reading, jump from one word to the next, right? Unless you've trained yourself to like read a whole sentence at one time, like in speed reading or something, all right? But then your eye jumps from one sentence to the next sentence. So it's still saccadic in nature. And even during a fixed gaze, when you're looking at something and not changing your vision, there are fixational movements. So even when you're looking right at something, your eye is shifting perspective a little bit, jumping around inside your head, because that prevents photoreceptor bleaching. Because once a photoreceptor is bleached, then you lose vision in that part of your retina. Like maybe, have you ever had your retina completely stimulated at one time? When did you have a retina completely stimulated at one time? Like when you say, smile, right? And so what do you see after that? Not much, because all of the rhodopsin has been bleached, right? And it takes a while to recuperate from that. Okay. So fixational movements help prevent that from happening. And there's a pupillary reflex which constricts the pupil in response to strong light. All right, so I think that's it for this chapter. Right, but this is a real important figure for you to be aware of. Okay, so the dark current, it's a depolarizing current, and under what conditions does the dark current operate? The dark current happens when there's no light. Yeah, no light. Is that what you said? I couldn't quite hear you. Okay, when there's no light. Therefore, we call it the dark current, causing depolarization of the rod cells. Okay, so I think that's it for this chapter. I couldn't cover that last time. All right, so let's move on to chapter 11. All right, so chapter 11 has to do with the endocrine system. That's just as an important system as the nervous system. The nervous system typically works over long distances in a very speedy fashion. It can transmit information very fast over long distances, but the duration of action of the nervous system usually is relatively short. As opposed to the endocrine system, it can work over long distances, but the duration of action is usually a lot longer. Okay, so it might in some cases it might take longer to have an effect on your body, but it will also have a much more long-lasting effect when hormones are in your blood. Okay, so endocrine glands. We have a number of endocrine glands, like we see testes right here, or ovaries. The pancreas is an endocrine gland, adrenal gland is important, thyroid gland, pituitary gland, the pineal gland, and the hypothalamus. So an endocrine gland has a couple characteristics. An endocrine gland is what we call a ductless gland. It is making some kind of product that it secretes out of a cell via exocytosis, and that product gets picked up by a capillary. And if it's picked up by a capillary, where is it? It's in the blood. And then where does it go once it's in the blood? Everywhere that the blood goes. It goes through your whole circulatory system. Okay? So that particular product then that's secreted from an endocrine gland or a ductless gland is what we call a hormone. Okay, that's a hormone. So endocrine glands are ductless glands that secrete hormones directly into the bloodstream. And hormones go to a target tissue or target cell. And the reason why a tissue may be a target tissue or a target cell is because it has to have a receptor for that hormone. If it doesn't have a receptor, then it's going to be completely oblivious to that hormone, even though the hormone concentration might be really high. So how would we explain how a receptor can sense a hormone? It has specificity, okay? It has competition. What are some things that had all of those things? And saturation. What are some things that had specificity, saturation? Oh, like enzymes and even carrier proteins, for instance. All right, so how did we explain how a substrate binds to an enzyme? Is it because they play the same music? Same color? Ah, that's good. By the shape, right? So the shape of a substrate has to match or be complementary to the shape of the active site. The same thing for a receptor hormone interaction, or the same thing for a receptor neurotransmitter interaction. It's by the shape of the molecules. They have to fit together. All right, so the shape of a hormone has to be complementary to the shape of the receptor in that particular cell. All right, neurohormones are secreted into the blood by specialized neurons. We're going to look at a condition in anatomy. We looked at one particular example of this. All right, so it would be, for instance, a neuron usually secretes, what does a neuron usually secrete? Like, what is acetylcholine typically? What do we call that? Neurotransmitter, right? So a neuron normally secretes a neurotransmitter. But if that neurotransmitter is absorbed into the circulatory system via capillary, then it's also acting like a hormone. So we have a little discrepancy. Is it a neurotransmitter or is it a hormone? So we come up with another term that encompasses both of those methods of action. So it's what we call a neurohormone, right? We just drop off the transmitter and put a hormone on there. So a neurohormone is a neurotransmitter, which is secreted directly into the blood by specialized neurons. And then that neurohormone will have an effect all over the body, not just at that one particular synapse. All right, so hormones affect metabolic targets. So how can a neurohormone have an effect on some kind of target cell or target tissue? What does that target tissue have to have in order to sense that neurohormone? It's got to have a receptor as well, just like a regular hormone. Okay? Okay. All right, so here's a list of some endocrine glands. We're going to talk about some of these glands, and I'm going to come back to this table. All right, but let's still talk about some of the basics. Chemical classification of hormones. Some are amine hormones, some are polypeptides, some are glycoproteins, some are steroids. And amine hormones are derived from tyrosine or tryptophan. Where did we run into tyrosine and tryptophan before? Yeah, they're the precursors for norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine. Okay. All the catecholamines. So these are norepinephrine, epinephrine. Norepinephrine you know as a neurotransmitter, but it can also be used as a neurohormone. All right, thyroxine. This is the thyroid hormone. Melatonin. It's another hormone. Are amine hormones. And these are all water-soluble hormones. Polypeptide or protein hormones. These are water-soluble hormones as well, so they dissolve in blood pretty easily. These are chains of amino acids. These include growth hormone. Guess what growth hormone does? Okay, yeah, it helps you grow up. Okay, ADH. Anybody know the name for ADH? The lung? Antidiuretic hormone. And from the name, you could pretty much figure out what its action is. What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. So an antidiuretic, yeah, makes you retain fluids. Right? So antidiuretic hormone makes you retain fluids. Insulin helps regulate blood glucose. Oxytocin is a smooth muscle stimulant. Glucagon has an antagonistic effect compared to insulin, so they work together. Insulin decreases blood glucose. Glucagon increases blood glucose. You probably run into that in lab. Adrenal corticotropic hormone. So that tells you what the target tissue is. It's the adrenal cortex. Adrenal cortex. And ACTH, or adrenal corticotropic hormone, helps maintain the adrenal cortex and causes release of hormones from the adrenal cortex. And then parathyroid hormone, polypeptide hormones. Glycoproteins are proteins with a sugar molecule on them, and these include LH, FSH, and TSH. LH and FSH help control reproductive cycles, and reproductive cycles in women and men as well, not so much in a cyclic nature, but in a tonic nature. And TSH is what stimulates the thyroid gland, maintains the thyroid gland, much like ACTH maintains the adrenal cortex. And these are all water-soluble hormones. Steroids are lipids. They're all derived from cholesterol. And y'all probably know that cholesterol in high concentrations in your body is deleterious to your health because it produces cardiovascular disease, but you have to have the right amount because what is made from cholesterol? Hormones that regulate reproductive nature of your body, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and even cortisol. All right, so these are some hormones. All right, so these right here, what do these look like to you? All right, so these are all steroids, right? This is going back way to your first test. And these are going to be lipid, these are all lipid-soluble hormones. All right, so this just shows how cortisol, estradiol, androstenedione, right, and testosterone all are derived from cholesterol in different endocrine glands. Okay, let's talk about some other classifications of hormones. All steroid and thyroid hormones are lipids. So what does that mean? If something is lipid, what does it need to get inside of a cell? What's the inner layer of a membrane? Is it lipid? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic, right, the phospholipid bilayer. It's hydrophobic, so all lipids can diffuse right through the plasma membrane. Right, you can even absorb these through your skin because they're lipid-soluble. And here are the two major thyroid hormones. So steroid hormones and thyroid hormones can diffuse right into the target tissues. They dissolve right through the plasma membrane. All right, so here are two important thyroid hormones. And the interesting thing about thyroid hormones is that they need this one little element right here. What's that I stand for? Can you remember your periodic table? Iodine, that's right. In order for thyroid hormone to have activity, it's got to incorporate iodine. And in one case, there are four iodines. We call that thyroxine or tetraiodothreonine. And the other one is triiodothreonine. We're missing an iodine group in this one location right here. Okay, but these are both lipid-soluble. So prohormones are precursors to hormones. So for instance, in most cases, when you see a word with a PRO as a prefix to something, right, that means that it's something like insulin, but it's in an inactive form. So your body can make a lot of insulin, for instance, but maybe it wants to keep it in reserve. It doesn't want it to be activated. So it makes it in a pro-insulin form. And then that pro-insulin can be converted very rapidly into insulin to produce an effect. So for instance, so the prefix is pro, and it could be maybe even an enzyme. So if you see proenzyme, what can you tell me about this particular enzyme right here? It is inactive. All right, there's some other terminology. Maybe there's another kind of protein. And in this particular case, forget about the pro here, okay? This is an exception to the rule. Okay, there's a protein, and if this protein is inactive, there's another way that we can designate that. We can say O-gen as a suffix. So if you ever see the name of a protein with an O-gen after it, again, you should know that it is in an inactive form, but your body has a lot of it ready to go into action at a moment's notice. So if you wanted this protein really fast, and you didn't have a lot of proteinogen in your body, how would your body get a lot of this protein? How does your body make protein? Muscle breakdown, yeah. That would take some time. Okay, but what can you tell me about protein synthesis? There's at least two steps to it. What's the first step? Transcription. And the second step is translation. So transcription happens inside the nucleus. Translation happens in the cytoplasm. So in order to make a lot of this protein, it's going to take a long time. It might take a week or so. But what if you need this protein today? Well, then you're out of luck. But what happens if your body makes a bunch of that protein, stores it in your body as this form right here, proteinogen? And then maybe there's an enzyme that chops off one part of this and it becomes the active protein. So this kind of activation can happen in seconds as opposed to days. And the same thing for this proenzyme. This enzyme can be converted into an active form almost immediately. You don't have to build this enzyme de novo from protein synthesis. So it's much faster. All right, so what are we looking at here? Pre-hormones are even precursors to pro-hormones, like pre-proinsulin is the next closest step to proinsulin. Some hormones are inactive until they are activated by the target cells. For instance, thyroxine is what's carried in your blood, which is tetradiiodothreonine. That's inactive, but when it enters a cell, the cell's converted into triiodothreonine, which is the active form. Okay, the other thing that maybe I could ask you about this T3 right here, right, we said that in order for a hormone to have activity, what does it have to have in the target tissue? It's got to have a receptor. Well, if it's a lipid-soluble molecule, where are the receptors? You're used to seeing receptors on the plasma membrane, but where are the receptors for lipid-soluble hormones? They have to be inside the cell. So they have to be either in the cytoplasm or maybe even in the nucleus. Okay. What step of protein synthesis takes place in the nucleus? Transcription. That's right. So some receptors actually initiate, when they bind their hormone, initiate transcription, which is what? Changing metabolism inside the cell by stimulating protein synthesis. All right, so hormone actions and interactions. Both the nervous system and the endocrine system use chemicals to communicate, right? They're going to be considered either neurotransmitters or hormones. Neurotransmitter will diffuse through a synapse. A hormone will be carried by the blood. The difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is in transport, right? Hormones are transported in the blood, and there's more diversity effects in hormone targets because they can have different kinds of receptors. And some chemicals are used both as hormones and neurotransmitters. Could you give me an example maybe of one that we talked about? Norepinephrine, perfect example, right? Okay. So targets for both neurotransmitters and hormones have to have specific receptor proteins. And that specific means, what, that they have to match up by shape. And if the molecule doesn't have the right shape, then it can't elicit some response in the target tissue. And there must be some way to rapidly inactivate both so that once the signal is sent, you're not stimulated for a long period of time. Okay, so a tissue usually can respond to a number of hormones. Two hormones are said to be synergistic if they work together to produce the same effect. All right, so that means they produce a larger effect together than if we were to add the individual effects together. So if we have two hormones, A and B, and if they both individually produce a response of one, if we put both A and B at the same time, the response is not going to be 2, but it might be 5 or 10 or something when they act synergistically. All right, a hormone has what we call a permissive effect if it enhances the responsiveness of the target organ to a second hormone. So maybe this second hormone by itself won't elicit any kind of response at all unless there is the presence of the first hormone. If the action of the first hormone inhibits the effect of the other, we call it antagonistic. That's not too hard to appreciate. Okay. So hormone levels, in terms of tissue responses, we talk about the half-life. All right? This is the time required for blood level to be reduced by half. And it ranges from minutes to hours for most, and actually days for thyroid hormones. Normal tissue responses are produced only when the hormones are in the physiologic range. And sometimes we might take hormones that go beyond the physiologic range. We call those pharmacological doses if it goes beyond a normal physiologic range. And it can cause a number of side effects in the body because these greater than normal concentrations can stimulate other cells that wouldn't normally respond to that particular hormone. And that probably happens because these hormones bind to receptors for other hormones that usually the concentration is so small that it doesn't really produce a response. So a high or a pharmacologic dose produces what? Atypical responses in target tissues. There's something that we call a priming effect. We call this upregulation. This occurs when a hormone induces morphosome receptors in a target cell. So if a hormone binds to a receptor in a target cell, that target cell responds by inserting more receptors into the cell membrane so that it is even more sensitive at a later time to even smaller concentrations of that hormone. We call that upregulation. So this results in a greater response to a target cell. That kind of reminds me of something. Does that remind anybody of something? What do you call that when a cell responds to a stimulus much more easily the second time or third time? Because the cell is putting more receptors into the membrane. Okay, so I would call that learning, okay, or long-term potentiation. So upregulation is a way for these cells to learn how to respond to these hormone signals. Desensitization, right, is the opposite of the priming effect. This is a downregulation. This occurs after long exposure to high levels of polypeptide hormones. Right, so subsequent exposure to this hormone produces a lesser response due to a decreased number in receptors in the target tissues. So the way that your body gets around this is the reverse of learning, right? Most peptide hormones are released in a pulsatile fashion. We call this pulsatile secretion, which prevents downregulation. So peptide hormones are released in a burst and then held back and then released in another burst, and that prevents downregulation. All right, let's look at some mechanisms. Target cell receptors show specificity. That means that the shape of the hormone has to match up with the receptor. All right, high affinity, that means that a receptor will respond to very low concentrations of hormone. All right, and low capacity for a hormone. That means that it can be downregulated. Lipophilic hormones have receptors in the target cytoplasm or in the nucleus because they can diffuse through the plasma membrane. All right. Their target is the nucleus where they affect transcription. We call this a genomic action of these hormones because they are affecting activation of various genes that are going to stimulate transcription and then translation and the production of proteins. This is relatively long. It takes at least 30 minutes to activate a gene. Whereas receptors for water-soluble hormones are on the surface of the target cell, these usually act through a second messenger system. They're just not ionotropic kinds of receptors that open up an ion channel, but they work by changing metabolism inside the cell through some kind of second messengers. These effects are quick, right? Because sometimes when we have a second messenger system, we have a series of coupled reactions. We call that a cascade, where one signaling molecule, one first messenger outside the cell, can create thousands or tens of thousands of second messengers inside the cell. And that's a step of amplification. So a cascade can produce amplification of that signal. Some steroids can also act on cell surface receptors. And in that particular case, the action of that steroid hormone is what we call non-genomic, right? Because it's not going to directly affect transcription inside the nucleus. All right, so you might be wondering, well, lipid hormones, how do they get around in the blood if they don't dissolve in blood? Because blood, the major component of blood is water, right? It's plasma, and the major component of plasma is water. All right, and that's because lipid hormones travel in the blood attached to carrier proteins, like we see right here. And that increases their solubility in water. And there is always an equilibrium established, right, between some hormone that is in the blood and the hormone that's bound to a carrier protein. And that fraction of hormone that's not bound to a carrier protein is free to diffuse across the plasma membrane. And that's also an equilibrium, right? And so if the hormone inside the cell is taken out of the cytoplasm, for instance, when it binds a receptor protein, it becomes lower concentration inside the cell. So what's going to happen to this hormone right here? Let's say if we decrease the concentration of hormone inside the cell, this free hormone dissolved in the plasma can either be rebound to the carrier protein or it can go inside the cell. Can you remember Le Chatelier's principle? All right, or another way of thinking of this, what happens if we decrease the concentration of hormone inside the cell? What is this hormone outside the cell going to want to do? Move down its concentration gradient. So there are a couple of different ways you can look at this, either a concentration gradient or Le Chatelier's principle, right? So when the signaling molecule inside the cell gets bound, then even more signaling molecule will move inside the cell. All right, and when the concentration in the plasma decreases, what happens to this carrier protein and hormone? It's going to dissociate, right? To try to build up the level of this hormone that's in the plasma. Again, that's just Le Chatelier's principle, because this is just under equilibrium conditions. So there's a natural flow of hormones from the carrier protein into the cell where it's going to have a response due to a concentration gradient and Le Chatelier's principle. Okay. Oh yeah, that Le Chatelier's principle. It just says if we have a couple of chemicals, A plus B going to C plus D, and let's just say it can go backwards as well. Okay, if we get rid of C, let's all of a sudden magically take it out, what's going to happen to this reaction? It's going to be stimulated to go in one direction or the other. It's going to take a lot of A and B, right? So A plus B is going to go down in concentration to what? Build up some C and produce some D. So it's going to find that balance again. Okay. Or, for instance, if we put a lot of C right here, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to force the reaction in the reverse. You're going to get a lot of A and B. All right. The concentration of C is going to go down, and the concentration of D is going to go down. So if we take hormones out of the cytoplasm, that's going to draw more hormone into the cell. Okay, due to the concentration gradient and the law of mass action, which is what I'm calling Le Chatelier's principle. All right, the receptors are what we call nuclear hormone receptors. All right, so here we see a receptor that's in the cytoplasm. It binds a hormone. It's going to translocate into the nucleus. And look, it can actually bind to DNA right here. And it can start the transcription of this particular gene. So nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors when bound to hormone ligands. Oh, let me go back. Because the nuclear hormone receptor, which is this thing right here, here's a nuclear hormone receptor, can't bind to the DNA unless it also binds, what, the hormone right here. So transcription can't take place until the nuclear hormone receptor actually binds the hormone. Then it can bind to the DNA, causing transcription. All right, so they serve as transcription factors. They initiate transcription when bound to hormone ligands. And then they can constitute a superfamily composed of steroid and thyroid hormones, which include vitamin D and retinoic acid. So let's look at some nuclear hormone receptors. All right, so they have two different domains, two different parts of the molecule. So here is the nuclear hormone receptor for steroid hormone. Here is the ligand binding part of it. Here is the DNA binding part of it. So we call this the ligand binding domain. This is the DNA binding domain. So first, the hormone has to bind to the ligand binding domain, and then it's going to translocate into the nucleus. And here's some DNA inside the nucleus. And here are some special binding sites that can bind to the DNA binding domain if there's a hormone bound to the ligand binding domain. And these are what we call half sites, because it just doesn't bind one receptor. It has to bind actually two receptors in order to initiate transcription. So we call this the dimerization of the receptors. So here we have two steroid hormones, and if both of these bind to the hormone response element, then transcription can take place, making messenger RNA, which can be used in translation. So this thing right here is what we call the hormone response element that can dimerize with the two activated receptor molecules, or the HRE. Right, so the HRE consists of two half sites, here and here. It has to bind two ligand-bound receptors, here and here. We call that dimerization, and that stimulates transcription. In terms of the thyroid gland, it secretes about 90% thyroxine and only 10% triiodothreonine. T4 is bound in the blood to carrier protein, which we call thyroid binding globulin, TBG, which then solubilizes T4. But only the free can enter cells, so the bound acts as a reservoir, right? And as soon as some T4 in the plasma enters a cell, then that releases some T4 from the thyroid binding globulin. And once inside the cell, T4 is converted into T3, and T3 binds to receptor protein located actually inside the nucleus. All right, so let's look at the mechanism of action for the thyroid hormone. All right, so T3 and receptor bind to one half site. So where do we have that? That's this one right here. Here's a thyroid hormone receptor, binds to a half site. The other half site binds to retinoic acid. These two different partners form a heterodimer. Why do we call this a heterodimer as opposed to a homodimer? Because they require different receptor proteins and they require different signaling molecules, different hormones. Right, in one case, it's retinoic acid, and the other is triiodothreonine. And if these are both present, then that's going to stimulate transcription of this particular target gene. Okay, so let's shift our attention to water-soluble hormones, which use surface receptors because they can't pass through the plasma membrane. So the actions are mediated by second messengers. The hormone is the first messenger That's the extracellular signal. So the extracellular signal is always what we call the first messenger. And the second messenger carries a signal from the receptor to inside the cell. And usually they never exchange places. So first messenger is outside, second messenger is inside. Adenylate cyclase is an enzyme that produces cyclic AMP. It mediates many of the effects of polypeptide and glycoprotein hormones. Hormones bind to receptor, causing dissociation of this G-protein subunit. The alpha unit then diffuses through the membrane. It binds to adenylate cyclase, which then catalyzes the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP, and then this pyrophosphate is just left over. This is just two phosphates bound together. Okay, cyclic AMP can bind to an inhibitory subunit on a protein kinase, right? And if the a protein kinase is going to phosphorylate enzymes someplace inside the cell, but if the inhibitory subunit is bound to it, it's going to be inactive. Cyclic AMP is going to knock off this inhibitory subunit when it binds to it. So now we just have the protein kinase, which is active, and this is going to phosphorylate proteins inside the cytoplasm, changing their activity, either opening up metabolic pathways or shutting metabolic pathways down. All right, so that's going, if it's opening up metabolic pathways, it's going to activate specific enzymes, or it can inactivate specific enzymes, turning off certain metabolic pathways. And a lot of times these work in tandem. Because, for instance, what can you tell me about glycolysis? Glycolysis is glucose going down to pyruvate. But pyruvate can go back up to glucose. What do we call that? Gluconeogenesis, right? So just by activating enzymes, you can stimulate glycolysis or gluconeogenesis depending on various signaling molecules outside the cell. Right, or by phosphorylating enzymes that control those metabolic pathways. Okay, I talked about that already. All right, furthermore, also inside the cell that is always active is phosphodiesterase. Phosphodiesterase is going to be always breaking down cyclic AMP, which is going to be continually reversing the effects of this signaling hormone outside the cell. All right, so if there's a lot of hormone, it can override the effect of phosphodiesterase, but when the signaling hormone disappears, then the activity of phosphodiesterase takes over, and this particular protein kinase will revert to the inactive form. Okay, phospholipase C and calcium works as a second messenger system for some hormones. So again, we have a hormone binding to a surface receptor. So what can you tell me about this hormone right here? What are some physical properties of this hormone? It is hydrophilic. That means it loves water, right? It can't diffuse through the plasma membrane because the plasma membrane is lipid in nature. And what else about this hormone? Is it a first messenger or second messenger? That's the first messenger because that's always outside the cell. All right, so it binds to this G-protein coupled receptor. Here are the G-proteins. They become activated, translocate through the membrane to phospholipase C. And phospholipase is an enzyme dissolved in the plasma membrane, and it produces inositol 3-phosphate, which we can just call IPI3, okay? And IPI3 comes from lipids. Well, where does phospholipase get lipids from? Phospholipase C have to go very far to find lipids? No, because what makes up a membrane? Lipids, there's plenty of lipids right there. So the plasma membrane, which we think of just as a structure, just a wrapping of a cell, is actually acting as a precursor to make signaling molecules inside the cell. So that's pretty ingenious that evolution has figured out how to use the plasma membrane, not just to separate the outside world from the inside, but to use it for signaling things inside the cell. Inositol 3-phosphate is going to diffuse through the cytoplasm, and it will cause the release of calcium from endoplasmic reticulum. Right, and calcium can then be used as a second messenger inside the cell to activate certain kinds of activity inside the cell. And when we get to smooth muscle, for instance, we'll see an example of that. Okay, so calcium is a signal. So IPE3 could be considered a second messenger, as well as calcium right here could be considered a second messenger due to phospholipase C activity. All right, so phospholipase C splits membrane phospholipid into second messengers, IPE3, as well as diacylglyceride. And maybe the next slide has the action for diacylglyceride. And so IPE3 causes calcium channels to open on smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So we've looked at this slide once before. So calcium diffuses into the cytoplasm, and it binds to a molecule that it is attracted to, namely calmodulin. And calmodulin, this was an exam figure, calmodulin activates protein kinases, which phosphorylate enzymes that can produce the hormone's effects inside the cell by opening up metabolic pathways. All right, so let's take a look at this slide right here. So here we have glycogen going to glucose 1-phosphate to glucose 6-phosphate, and then this can be dephosphorylated to produce free glucose that can go into the blood. So this would be, for instance, typically what we might see in a liver cell, not a muscle, because liver cells are the only cells that can release free glucose. Every other cell in the body, once glucose gets in, can never leave because they don't have the glucose 6-phosphatase enzyme. All right, so how can this happen? Well, here we have a beta-adrenergic receptor that's going to bind epinephrine, all right, and that's going to be through a G protein-coupled receptor, and that's going to activate adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase converts ATP into cyclic AMP. That's the second messenger inside the cell, which activates protein kinases. Right, which then break down glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate, right, and glucose 6-phosphate, which is going to cause the release or secretion of glucose into the blood, increasing blood glucose. All right, so what was the initial stimulus for this? It was epinephrine. So epinephrine on liver cells can cause blood glucose levels to increase through this mechanism right here. All right. Liver cells also have alpha-adrenergic effects, right? And that's going to cause calcium to be released, which will bind to calmodulin, which will activate protein kinases, which are going to activate this metabolic pathway. So what is this metabolic pathway? Glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate. What's that called? Glycolysis is what? Glucose to pyruvate. That's down over here. But glycogen to glucose is, it's got to be glycogen something. It's glycogen lysis, but we don't call it that. What do we really call it? Glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis. All right, so here are two receptors, the beta adrenergic and the alpha adrenergic, right, stimulating or opening up glycogenolysis through the mechanisms that we have just looked at. I don't know if this is an exam figure. Probably not. Okay. That is? Okay. Well, this is the one that's really interesting. All right, so a tyrosine kinase, second messenger system. So here we have a nice plasma membrane here and here, and we got a couple protein molecules that span the plasma membrane. And it looks like there's a receptor site on the extracellular side of this membrane right here. So this is a surface receptor. And this part here is the tyrosine kinase enzyme. So it consists of two subunits. Right? When insulin binds, These two subunits come together to form a dimer. Okay, so this is the first step, dimerization. And it can, once it's dimerized, it can bind an ATP and become phosphorylated. All right, so that's phosphorylation of the receptor. Now, tyrosine kinase is now active. So this particular receptor enzyme, insulin is bound to it, it's been activated. So now it is stuck in the membrane. It can actually phosphorylate tyrosine amino acids on proteins someplace. So here's a protein, right? And with the help of ATP, this tyrosine kinase can phosphorylate this particular tyrosine amino acid in this protein. And this is going to cause a cascade of effects, which is going to allow glucose uptake and anabolism of glucose. And we're going to see how that happens in just a little bit. So this is a nice insulin receptor. So probably what you should have on the tip of your tongue is that insulin receptors are what? Receptor enzymes, and of a particular class that we call tyrosine kinase receptors. So insulin receptors are tyrosine kinase receptors. And what's the bottom line for an insulin receptor? What's it going to do? What does insulin do in the body? It decreases blood glucose because it allows glucose to enter cells. So without that insulin signal, glucose is trapped outside the cell. It can't get inside. And there are people that suffer from that abnormal process. What do we call that, that disease process? That's diabetes, right? So, for instance, there's a certain kind of diabetes that we suspect this particular kind of receptor is not operating correctly. Right? Maybe the insulin level is fine, but this receptor right here, the tyrosine kinase receptor, is not operating correctly. All right? And that's what we call diabetes type 2. And I think we've talked about everything on this slide already. Okay. So how does this happen? Insulin stimulates glucose uptake by means of the GLUT4 carrier molecules. So why can't glucose just enter a cell? Why can't glucose just enter a cell? Because it is hydrophilic. A molecule has to be hydrophobic to go through the plasma membrane. So in order for glucose to enter a cell, it's got to have a transporter molecule, an active transporter molecule. And most glucose can enter a cell with this transporter molecule going from high concentration to low concentration. What do we call the movement of a material from high concentration to low concentration, high to low? That's just diffusion, right? But in this particular case, diffusion can't happen if there are no transporter molecules in the membrane. There has to be transporter molecules. So this is just diffusion, but it's not simple diffusion. What do we call that kind of special diffusion that needs a transporter molecule in the membrane? We call that facilitated diffusion. So glucose uptake is due to facilitated diffusion. Okay, so how does this happen? Well, here is the receptor enzyme, the tyrosine kinase, receptor for insulin. When insulin binds, that activates the tyrosine kinase that produces signaling molecules which have an effect on these vesicles that are inside the cell. And these vesicles have a special name to them. We usually call these endosomes. Like a lysosome is a vesicle inside the cell that can break things apart. An endosome is just a vesicle that's inside the cell. Endo means inside the cell. And what can you tell me about this endosome right here? It has a special membrane component. What's in this endosome right here? It's got the GLUT4 transporters, but in this particular case, they're not going to be useful for moving glucose inside this vesicle. But nonetheless, these proteins are inserted into the membrane of this vesicle. All right. When insulin binds, it's going to signal the translocation of this endosome, including these transporters, to the cell membrane. And guess what happens when it reaches the cell membrane? It can fuse together. The endosome and the cell membrane can fuse together. So now the membrane of the endosome is really part of the cell membrane, and it carries along the GLUT4 transporter, so that effectively inserts all of these GLUT4 transporters that are non-functioning in the endosome into a functional position in the cell membrane, translocating glucose down its concentration gradient so glucose can enter the cell. All right, so without this insulin molecule, there are processes that are always taking the GLUT4 transporters and moving them back into endosomes. All right, and when insulin is signaling the tyrosine kinase, then the endosomes get put back into the cell membrane and glucose can enter the cell. And so this is pretty handy, because putting all these GLUT4 transporters into the membrane is a relatively speedy process. Right? If you had to build these GLUT4 transporters de novo from amino acids, right, it could take you hours or days to build enough GLUT4 transporters for this cell to take up glucose. But when they're in an endosome, they're what? They're in an inactive form and a reservoir ready to go to work as soon as this insulin signal becomes apparent. Okay, so I want you to be familiar with this this endosome right here. Let's see if there's anything else I want to say about this slide. Okay, so the cell can change, can flip back and forth to being able to import glucose or not import glucose very quickly based on this insulin signal right here. Okay, so don't forget about that tyrosine kinase. All right, so next time we're going to start with the pituitary gland, and maybe for next time you might even want to look at your anatomy book and look at some of the anatomy of the anterior pituitary, posterior pituitary, and the... Did anybody take an anatomy class from me? What did I call this little thing right here? That's the infundibulum, but what do we call that structure that connects major parts of the brain? Like there's a major part of the brain that connects the cerebellum with the pons. They're called the cerebellar peduncles. And then there's a major part of the brain that connects the brainstem with the cerebrum. We call that the cerebral peduncles. So this thing right here sort of looks like a peduncle, but it's really small. All right, so what did I call it? I call that the peduncolito. All right, but don't use that term outside this class. Okay, it's a small peduncle, peduncolito. Okay, otherwise known as the infundibulum or the stalk.